You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for our discussion, The World Economy on a Precipice. My name is Sandra Pulaski. I head the Trade, Equity, and Development Program here at Carnegie, and I will be the moderator today. As we're all aware, the world economy is in the grip of a crisis which has contributed to a severe contraction of production and of trade that has led to layoffs and unemployment, which has led to further reduction in demand, further reductions in trade and production. My colleague, Uri Dadush, who recently joined the Carnegie Endowment to head a new program here at Carnegie on the international economy, has organized this panel of experts and leaders to examine the outlook for the world economy, for developed and developing country markets, and the prospects for maintaining an open global trading system. Let me briefly introduce our panel. You have longer biographies in your material, so I will be very brief here. We will hear first from Jörg de Kressen, who heads the World Economic Studies Division in the Research Department of the IMF and coordinates the production of the IMF's World Economic Outlook. A German national, he joined the IMF after he obtained his PhD from Harvard University in 1993. Next, we will have a presentation by Hans Timmer, the lead economist in the World Bank's Development Prospects Group and manager of the Global Trends Team, which is responsible for the bank's annual publications, Global Economic Prospects and Global Development Finance. Following Hans, we will hear the views of Ambassador John Bruton, the ambassador to the United States of the European Union Commission. The ambassador was formerly Prime Minister of Ireland. In that capacity, he helped transform the Irish economy into the Celtic Tiger, one of the fastest growing economies in the world, and advanced the Northern Irish peace process. Before that, he held several ministerial positions in the Irish government, including finance, industry, and trade. Finally, we will hear from my colleague, Uri Dadush, who is a senior associate and the director in the Carnegie's new International Economics Program, which will focus on trends in the global economy and the global financial crisis. A French citizen, Uri previously served as the World Bank's Director of International Trade for 6 years, and before that as Director of Economic Policy for the bank. Let me call on Mr. de Kressen to begin.
Thank you very much for this introduction, and thank you. From the perspective of the advanced economies. So I'm proposing to talk to you about how we see the prospects for advanced economies and where we see the policy priorities at the current juncture. So let's start first with some data. What you see in this chart is industrial production and merchandise exports. This is at the global level. And what you remark there at the far right of the chart is that both are really taking a fall off the cliff for the moment. I should point out that the decline in merchandise export and industrial production is particularly deep in the advanced economies. So a large part of this fall of the cliff is actually taking place in advanced economies. And if you dig a little deeper, a good part of it can be explained by the sharp decline in the demand for consumer durables in the advanced economies, which, you know, cars are perhaps the best example. So it's really a very large decline in trade. I'm sure that my colleague from the World Bank will comment further on this also from the perspective of the emerging economies. It is an event that perhaps if you try to dig in history, you would have to go back to the early 1980s to find something that is similar but not quite as deep as what we're seeing right now. So what we are expecting is that the world economy that real GDP at the global level will contract in 2009. A contraction would be a first since World War II. Here I want to focus on the advanced economies, which you see in the red line. You see here a chart on real GDP growth that goes back all the way to the 1970s. And if you focus on the right end of the chart, right, you see that we are in territory that we haven't been not even nearly close to. Over the last 30 years, and it's also the largest decline since World War II in the advanced economies. We're expecting a contraction of about of over 3% in 2009 in output in the advanced economies. And then for 2010, we expect stagnation. So it's a pretty deep recession. This chart here offers you a little more country detail. What you see here is that for all the major areas in the advanced economies, the U.S., the euro area, and Japan, we see large contractions in 2009 by about 2.5% in the U.S., about 3% in the euro area, and by about 6% in Japan. Then if you look at 2010, you basically see that we are projecting at the moment broadly zero growth for real GDP. I should stress that all of these projections are not yet final. Our final WEO forecast will be made published on April 22nd, and more likely than not, the final numbers will be lower rather than higher than the ones that I'm presenting to you right here. This is illustrated by the way we see risks distributed around our forecast. This is our first take at an assessment of the likely distribution of growth forecasts. The dark blue shaded center of the graph kind of shows you where we expect world growth to be in 2009, right around a 0.5% to minus 1%. And then we expect world growth in 2010 to be in a range between 1.5% and 2.5%. But then when you start, if you want to become more confident about what you're forecasting, you would have to widen that interval, because the further out you go, the less confident we are about our forecast. And I expect that once we have refined this analysis and come up with the final numbers, the fan chart will be looking even wider, meaning the risks around our forecasts are much wider, and they will remain tilted to the downside, which is what they are already here very clearly so in 2009. So what are the assumptions behind the recovery in 2010? I mean, it's not really a recovery in a sense, because, the growth rates will be still modest. On an annual average basis, there will be around zero for 2010. On a Q4 basis, which is another way of looking at it, they'll be slightly positive. So what are the assumptions, in terms of us getting from contractions to small growth in 2010? Well, first, we are assuming that the monetary easing that has taken place will feed through to the economy and offer support to activity. There has also been significant fiscal stimulus. And moreover, we are also assuming that financial conditions begin to improve based on a stabilization in the U.S. housing market. Now let's go over these various points in some depth. First, as you can see from this chart here, which shows you policy rates, and I'd like you to focus on the red, the yellow, and the green lines, which are for the United States, the euro area, and Japan, respectively. What you see is that in these three major areas, policymakers have kept either rates very low and cut them slightly further, or have cut them quite considerably from high levels. Like the United States, we're coming from levels of near 6% to close to zero. In Japan, we were barely above zero, and now we're again closer to zero. And in the euro area, we've come from rates of around 4.5% to 1.5% right now, and markets are expecting further cuts by the ECB. But that's not all. What these central banks have also done is they have loosened collateral requirements. You're getting money more readily from them. They have lengthened maturity, meaning banks can obtain money for longer from the central banks. And some of them have also intervened directly in asset markets, purchasing assets in order to support prices and getting credit to flow again. Similarly, fiscal policy is quite supportive of activity. What you're seeing here is focus on the red line, which is for advanced economies. These economies posted fiscal balances that were in deficit of around, just a little bit less than 2% of GDP in 2006 and 2007. And as a result of fiscal stimulus, as well as the operation of automatic stabilizers, which basically is about tax revenues declining as economic activity declines. On account of these two, fiscal balances will deteriorate to around deficits of 8% of GDP in 2009, and at this stage still recover modestly in 2010. I'll talk about that later. But the bottom line is that fiscal policy has been quite accommodative and that this should be supporting activity and a recovery. So what more needs to be done? Well, first, with respect to macroeconomic policies, it's basically in some ways more of the same, meaning monetary policy will continue to have to remain easy, can be eased further in some areas, such as in the euro area, by cutting interest rates, but then also expand on unconventional measures to support activity. Again, the Fed has pretty much pulled all the stops. The latest one was to purchase treasury bills. The Bank of England is doing the same thing. The Bank of Japan is intervening in equity markets, and the European Central Bank is basically further providing funding at even longer maturities than it has so far, and engaging in other special operations in order to affect credit markets beyond the usual channel, which is via interest rates. The second point is fiscal policy. Fiscal policies will need to remain accommodative. I mean, at this stage, as you had seen in the previous chart, there's a little bit of a pullback in 2010, and we believe that in 2010 in advanced economies there is a case to implement further measures to ease fiscal policy. So additional stimulus is probably required in 2010. It would be a mistake to withdraw stimulus at that stage when the economy is likely not to be on a solid path to recovery. So further stimulus will be needed in advanced economies. And then the final point, which is the sine qua non. Policies need to be implemented to heal the financial sector. And I will get back to these in the next few slides. But before that, I just wanted to share with you a little bit of analysis that we have done on recessions. We've basically looked at a large number of recessions in advanced economies since the 1960s and distinguished between two types of recessions, those that were caused by a financial crisis and those that were, or the average run-of-the-mill recession, those that were not necessarily caused by a financial crisis. So what I'm showing to you here is, the probability that a recession survives, depending on its characteristics. The red line shows it to you for the full sample, right? So basically, what the red line shows to you, the probability of survival is near zero after six quarters. So, if you're really unlucky with your standard recession, if you're really unlucky, then, it takes you six quarters to get out of it. Now, if you look at the yellow line, which plots the same thing, but for recessions that were preceded or caused by a financial crisis, as identified in the literature, you can see that it takes you way longer to get out of it, to be sure to have gotten out of it. So what did we then do? We then thought, okay, fine, we can decompose the financial crisis-driven recessions into those where there's been a strong fiscal or strong monetary policy response, right, and see what happens to the probability of survival under these circumstances. And that's illustrated by the blue and by the green lines, which are in between, and they basically show you that the probability of survival of a financial crisis-driven recession diminishes quite appreciably, on the order of 20% at any point in time, if you have a strong macroeconomic policy response in place. Now, let me again get back to the key policy challenge, which is to restore the financial sector to health. What we have been pushing for is a three-pronged approach consisting of generous provision of liquidity to banks, which the central banks everywhere have been doing and are continuing to do so, dealing with solvency, which is basically providing financial institutions, banks that have run out of capital or have capital below the levels that markets are expecting, providing them with additional capital in order for them to again be able to operate on a solid footing and not having to cut back credit in line with the reduction in capital that they are suffering because of the losses on toxic and other assets. And the final point, the third point, is dealing with the bad assets, that is removing these bad assets from the balance sheets of the banks. And that's perhaps the area where least progress has been made. The Fed has just in the last couple of days announced a new initiative to make more progress on this front, and we very much welcome this initiative. But you know, what we think is basically that this initiative will certainly create demand for bad assets. The question is still whether banks will be ready to supply these assets at lower prices, or whether they not rather hold on to them on maturity and value them at prices that are higher than what is currently being offered in the marketplace. That is something that remains to be seen. But here I'm also coming to the key risk in terms of our forecast. I said the risks were on the downside, and what is perhaps the most important downside risk? It is that the political economy is turning increasingly less favorable to financial sector restructuring. What is clear is that significant amounts of public funds all over the advanced economies, many advanced economies, will be needed in order to restore banks to health. And the support in the broad population for this currently is not very strong. And if it's not strong, then that will hold up the recapitalization. And the longer recapitalization is being held up, the more credit will be cut back by the banks. And the more credit is being cut back, the more activity will suffer. The more activity suffers, the more asset prices will go down. And so you have a vicious circle until you find some bottom that could take place. So just this is the last slide on the medium-run challenges. I mean, what kind of lessons are we drawing from the crisis? Let me just point out a few of them. It's clear that we need to broaden the perimeter of financial regulation. You know, it cannot only cover banks. It also has to cover investment banks. It cannot only cover banks. It also has to cover special-purpose vehicles and other institutions. We also need to make an effort to move over-the-counter trading onto organized markets, which will make the flows more transparent and give people a clearer appreciation of the risks. And then perhaps the biggest challenge is to make monetary policy, you know, more, is to move monetary policy in a direction where it takes account of financial sector risks, and to move financial sector policy into a direction where it takes account of the macroeconomic cycle. This is a very complex field. It sounds simple, but the reason it hasn't been done is because it's so complex, and we can talk about that later maybe in the questions and answers. And the final point we are pushing very strongly is there needs to be more coordination. If you have a world where everything is financially so connected as it is right now, then countries that implement policies to address their financial sector challenges will need to bear in mind the repercussions of their policies on other countries. So let me give you an example. A country gives guarantees to its banks in its territory. Well, this will have immediate consequences because then people in other countries remove their assets to the banks in this country that is offering guarantees. And so you will be affecting other countries in the process. And most often the countries that get most affected are those in the emerging market world. And why is that the case? That's because they are not fiscally as strong. They don't have the same strong access to markets for them to be able to come up with credible guarantees. So there's a real issue here with respect to coordination. Countries will need to move together when they are working on their policies to heal financial sectors. And with this, I'm done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jörg. In the interest of time, let's go directly to Hans for the presentation.
Direction. Sorry about that. So good afternoon again.
Thank you, Uri.
And thank you, Uri. I feel a little bit awkward because as a guest I almost come empty-handed because I basically only have one chart to show to you, which is this one. And that's actually a different form of the first chart that that Jörg already has shown you. I have no forecast to give you for reasons I will tell in a moment. But I will try to provide some food for thought, and I'm very much looking forward to the discussion, actually. So this is a chart that we at the bank are looking a lot at. We update it every night. It is world industrial production consisted of more than 100 countries put together. And it's a very raw data because this is month over month growth. And we find it always fascinating. And for you, it's probably just a cloud, but there are lots of things that you can read in it. One way of reading something in it, this starts in 1919 and goes to the summer of 2008, is by splicing it somewhat, or do 12 months over 12 months growth rate, and then suddenly you see a pattern emerging. You see in the early 2000s the dot-com crisis, the burst of the bubble. You see, which is at a global scale not that big, but in 1908, the East Asian crisis reflected in those numbers. And then in the early 90s, you see the recession in high-income countries, which was not synchronized, started first in the United States and then moved to Europe. And that is very important for us. What you also see is that over the last 10 years, there was exceptionally strong and steady growth in the world economy. And if you look at other indicators, then you will see exactly the same pattern. Now, you can go one step further in trying to analyze this chart, and that is looking still at that the trend line, but then split the trend line for the high-income countries, the yellow one here, and for the low and middle-income countries. And then you see that strong growth that you saw over the last, say, 8 years, that was mainly due to very, very strong performance in the developing world. There was really an acceleration throughout the developing world that was not due because of what happened in the high-income countries, but was because of reforms in many developing regions, because those regions entered international markets and were able to benefit from catching up in productivity. And this is not really a China story. It's not even a China and India story. If you take China and India out, you see even more of an acceleration. So that cloud that we started with actually has a lot of information on what happened in the global economy. But let's go back to that cloud that I started with and then add the last 6 months. So this is really, really exceptional what happened. We are completely off the chart. The world economy is underwater. What started in the middle of September as the failure of with the failure of Lehman Brothers as a financial crisis, a panic, as a result of which all kinds of banks, financial institutions started repatriating their investments from overseas, drawing back a lot of capital also from the developing world, started deleveraging their balance sheets, had immediately an enormous impact on the real economy. Within half a year, the world economy lost 15% of its industrial production. That's only in half a year. And what is striking is that it happened everywhere. There is no country exempted. You see, in some countries it's somewhat harder, but almost within no time, every corner of the world sees this same kind of picture. And that is not because we have a lot of trade linkages and this is basically a U.S. problem. This is because all countries are directly hit in their domestic economy. This is because also developing countries are seeing now investments suddenly collapsing, and indeed demand for durable goods and cars are declining in China and in South Africa and in India. The financial crisis has an enormous impact on the real economy. So already in October, we wrote that this was something that would hit all countries in their domestic economy. We expected a contraction of world trade for 2009. Earlier this year, we wrote that the world economy would contract as a whole and that there would be lots of vulnerabilities. But now we are updating those forecasts again, and they will be more pessimistic. I just came back from the board at the World Bank to discuss the different aspects that are linked to this phenomena and the consequences for the bank. We will have tomorrow another board meeting on that. And at the end of the month, we will give an update of our forecast for the world economy. And that's why I cannot share the data here with you, because we will do that together with Bob Zelik, and he has really emphasized that we cannot, we should keep our ammunition dry. But what is important to note is that it has so many different aspects. It is not just the fall in production, the fall in trade. You saw commodity prices collapsing. It's hitting first the private sector in all kinds of in almost all economies. But now what we are very worried about is the problems that are arising in government sectors, because the revenues of governments are collapsing. At the same time, there is an attempt to stimulate the economies. You see that the borrowing costs are going up. So very rapidly we see that the sovereign sector is deteriorating, and also. And what we are very worried about is the problems on the current account, especially in Eastern Europe, where there are still lots of countries where the current account deficits are close to 10% of GDP, with the fall in the capital flows that creates huge risks for many, many countries in the world. This is the picture that we have. My last chart is going to the countries to see that although all countries are affected, some are affected even more than others. What you're seeing here is the decline in industrial production since the summer. So you see that especially a couple of capital goods exporters, countries that are specialized in the production of investment goods, are hit very hard, very much in line with the story that we told earlier on already, that this was a financial crisis that would hit immediately the investment sector. But you see, for example, that Taiwan has lost more than 40% of its production within half a year. Japan, Germany is there in the line. What you also see is that there are a couple of really vulnerable countries at the moment in the developing world, especially in Eastern Europe, but some of them also in Latin America, where the decline in production is especially hard. What I want to do, since you already had a forecast and I'm not allowed to give you a forecast, I want to pose two issues on the table that I would be very much interested in discussing. The first one is what I would call the need for a long-term perspective at the moment when we are discussing policy options. In my view, too much we are discussing now policies, governments that have to go all out as if there is no tomorrow. And I think that's very dangerous for a couple of reasons. The reason why people are talking about it like that is they say we have a crisis at the moment. It is really a disaster, and in a disaster you have to rescue people, and you are not organizing meetings for structural reforms or structural discussions. That might be, but with some of the policies undertaken at the moment, if they are not put into a longer-term perspective, then you might create actually problems in the medium run for several reasons. First of all, we do think that if you look at the developing countries, that there is still this very strong underlying growth potential. That growth potential that was responsible for the very strong growth that I illustrated this decade with the industrial production numbers. After everything settles down, and after there's a rebound, and there will be a rebound, even if it's uncertain when it will be, that strong growth can come back in developing countries. This was not a crisis that originated there. This was a crisis of financial sectors in the high-income countries. Many developing countries went through a period of very strong reforms, have good policies in place, and it's very dangerous now to change those policies and to create a debt in the medium run that could frustrate that that growth. That is one reason. The other reason is perhaps even more important, and that is that one of the problems at the moment, why you see the collapse in the world economy, is that there is complete lack of confidence in the world economy, and investors don't want to invest. They sit on their money. Consumers, they want to save. And one thing that you can do with your policy is try to rebuild that confidence again. And you cannot rebuild that confidence by just announcing very big programs. You only rebuild that confidence by showing people where you will be 5 years from now, what ultimately the role of those policies is. And finally, I think that the fact that there is at the moment a lot of funding available to rebuild the economy, and this is a moment really to decide how to spend that money, and that's why you hear from the World Bank many times now suggestions of investment funds that can be invested in developing countries to address the bottlenecks that that have arisen over the last decade that have to be addressed so that you can have stronger growth in the coming decades. It is very important to spend the money now in a productive way so that you can support growth. That is also a way to try to prevent huge fiscal problems in the future. So that is that is one issue that I think is important. The second issue is about globalization. And there is a lot of fear at the moment that there is a huge backlash against globalization. Throughout the world, you see protectionary measures. We are very much afraid that this is a discussion that starts also in Africa. Africa started relatively late with reforms, but had recently also a lot of success in opening up their economies, integrating into the financial markets. And now you see a backlash because they see the negative consequence of for the first time trying to use also foreign funding and private funding, and they try to reverse that. So there is an enormous backlash, but what I want to put on the table is that there might also be an opportunity actually of getting a new start of globalization and perhaps a different start with different leaders and with different objectives. Because one thing that might happen as a result of this crisis, that you see somewhat of a rotation of the forces of growth in the global economy, somewhat away from the United States that had a dominant position, much more towards Asia. And what might happen is that those who will benefit most from further globalization, and that is many of the Asian countries, will now take much more the lead than they have done over the last decade. So in sense of, instead of retreating and going back to where we were during the 60s and the 70s, you might actually see also a change in globalization. So those are the two elements that I want to put on the table. Want to sit here?
Thank you, Hans. Ambassador.
We can't underestimate the extent of the problems that the world economy is now facing. In the United States, there's been a rapid decline in household wealth and a sharp rise in unemployment. The U.S. economy shrank by 6.2% in the last quarter of last year, and in the euro area, the decline was 5.8%. One must, of course, recognize that employment levels from which these declines are taking place was at an historic all-time high. More worrying for the future is the fact that there has also been a steep fall in capacity utilization in the economy. Part of the current problem relates to toxic assets. On behalf of the European Union, I strongly welcome the measures announced by the US government in recent days to deal with these assets. Using the expertise of the private sector to price these assets is wise, especially as the private sector will lose or gain depending on the wisdom of its decisions. We do not underestimate the difficulties in this process. The assets that are to be valued are inherently complex and heterogeneous, and the information available about them is inadequate. It is also important to stress that quite apart from the issue of toxic assets, the banking system probably needs significant recapitalization. In some European countries, this has been achieved by debt for equity swaps, i.e. the government puts money in return for shareholding, part or wholly nationalization, in other words. I can understand that this isn't an easy option for the United States to adopt, although there are precedents for it, continental Illinois being one. And I also would agree that the political economy of recapitalizing banks is quite difficult, particularly in the United States. And this is because, essentially, the fact that banks are public utilities, just as like roads, sewage systems, electricity grids, and the like, the fact that they are public utilities has not been explained to the public by the politicians. Banks are not like automotive companies. They're not like companies producing detergents. They're not like any of these products for which demand may rise or fall depending on consumer tastes. Banks, like roads and like railways, are part of the essential system of public utilities without which there would be no economy. And it seems to me that the discourse about assisting banks at the moment in this country has completely ignored the public utility character of banks. And for one, as somebody who's been a politician for 35 years, I do not understand why the politicians in this country have failed to explain that banks are public utilities, and why in the discussion that's taking place on these matters, that those words, public utility, are not in fact being used, because I think people understand. For example, the railway system in my country, which was private in the 19th and early 20th century, because of the difficulties experienced in the 20s and 30s, the railways were not allowed to close, they were nationalised, so that we could still have a railway system, which we now have the option of privatising if we want to, or not, as the case may be. But the natural thing was to ensure that those utilities stayed in being. Why isn't the same simple case that a very simple people, the Irish people in the 1930s, could be persuaded to accept at a level of sophistication much less than the current American population? Why is that case not being made about banks at this time? They are public utilities, period. I would also like to stress that I'm very supportive of the work that the administration is doing to stimulate the US economy separately from the recapitalization of banks. The stimulus bill will reduce what would otherwise be a radical decline in the economy. I wish to respond to one criticism that is sometimes voiced of government stimulus of the economy in current circumstances. This is the criticism that the increased government indebtedness involved may ultimately lead to inflation, to higher interest rates, and to the problem, aggravate the problem of dealing with the consequences of aging in Western societies. While each of these are legitimate worries, the truth is that the present decline in the economy in 2009 is so rapid and radical that if it is not mitigated by government stimulus, there will be a precipitous decline in production capacity. For example, if a mine closes, it's not easy or cheap to reopen it. If a factory closes, it's not all that easy either to reopen it. Likewise, if transport links are permanently closed down because of lack of demand, they are not, in many cases, easily reopened. Thus, if a radical downswing in production capacity occurs because of current short-term thinking, short-term conditions, that could actually increase longer-term inflation and longer-term deficit worries. For example, the decline in tax revenue in an economy without stimulus could add more to government debt than the stimulus itself in the short run. Furthermore, if production capacity is shut down, there is a risk of a significant spike in inflation as soon as demand resumes, whereas if a modicum of production capacity is maintained, that rapid upswing in inflation is less likely to occur. I believe the essential task, therefore, facing governments today is one of smoothing out the otherwise radical swings in the economy that might occur so as to maintain long-term production capacity. And I think that's how it should be presented. Stimulus is the wrong word. Stabilization would be a better word to explain what we're doing, just as public utility maintenance would be a better word to use what we're doing at the banks than rescue. And I think words make a difference. Words are what have become embedded in people's minds, and if we choose the wrong words to explain what we're doing, we shouldn't be surprised that people don't understand what we're doing. Of course, this does not mean, when I talk of maintaining production capacity, that there need be no structural change. Some of the patterns of consumption that obtained in the recent past were unsustainable and ought never to be returned to. The level of environmental degradation that arose from the artificial and unsustainable consumer-driven society, for example, in this country, fueled by borrowing and destroying the global environment, we don't want to return to that. And we should not try to do so. But the journey towards a more sustainable economic model should be undertaken in a deliberate and phased way rather than by radical shock therapy of the kind that would otherwise kill the patient, which is what we're heading for unless we have what they call stimulus. As far as the European Union is concerned, we have been providing funds to stimulate our individual national economies in accordance with the individual room for fiscal manoeuvre that each country has. We have also, in conjunction with the IMF, been providing funds to assist some EU member states and European non-members who have got into particular difficulties. We would caution also against sweeping generalisations about Central Europe. Some Central European countries have very sound positions and are enjoying more growth than many other European countries are. Finally, it is vitally important, as has been stated, that global leaders work together to resolve these problems. We support US proposals to increase funds for the International Monetary Fund, and I'm sure the World Bank as well. For the credibility of our stimulus measures, it's also important that the causes of the current difficulties are seen to be dealt with as well. That is why European proposals, for example, for better regulation of the financial sector, are fully compatible with short-term fiscal stimulus measures. In fact, they complement one another. And I'm confident there that that will be the conclusion of the G20 on the 2nd of April. There is no contradiction between US ideas on stimulus and European ideas on regulation. The stimulus is more credible if it's accompanied by regulation, and the regulation is more credible if it's accompanied by stimulus. This is not some sort of a struggle between two concepts. Rather, it's a complementary situation. And to conclude, I agree very much that stimulus or stabilization is more credible if it is accompanied by dealing with longer-term issues. For example, a short-term stimulus of some of the European economies would be more credible if it was accompanied by medium to long-term decisions to increase the pension age. Stimulus of the US economy would be more credible if it was accompanied by decisions in the medium to long term to reduce eligibility for Medicare and Medicaid. In each country, there are different medium to long term fiscal problems or entitlement problems, which if you deal with them in the medium to long term, but make the decisions now, that makes your stimulus in the short run more credible because people can see how you're going to pay for it in the long run. If you just have stimulus without making the long-term decisions and making them while there's a crisis on, which is the easy time to do it, rather than putting them into the medium future, as seems to be the pattern that's being adopted currently, where people are talking about deficit targets but not saying how they're going to achieve those targets, talking about fundamental reform but not making the decisions in the reform. I mean, talk about fundamental reform is cheap. Decisions are sometimes politically expensive, but that's what we need at this time. Thank you.
Let's see. This is working?
Yep. Okay, well, I must say I've listened with rapt attention to my co-panelists. Very crucial time. I'm going to make three main points today. One is we need to be modest in our forecasting right now. The second point is that it may well be that the recovery in 2010 is the most likely forecast, but I think we should consider the possibility that we will face a depression. And I will define a depression in a moment. And because I believe a depression scenario is a genuine possibility, I believe that the proposals currently on the table of the G20 do not go far enough, and that we need to use all the available policy space. These are my three points. Let me just quickly go through them. The first point about modesty in forecasting. I was forecasting a year ago with Hans, so, and I made the same mistakes. So these are my mistakes as much as anybody's, anybody else's out there. Who imagined a year ago that in 2009, the WTO would predict that world trade is going to decline by 9% this year? Who imagined that the global economy would contract? World Bank and IMF forecast. Who imagined that the US budget deficit would reach 13% of GDP, that is the CBO projections? And so on. Who would imagine the disappearance of investment banks? And I could go on and on. The basic point is that the normal standards do not apply to this particular recession, and this is handsomely brought out in Hans's graph here on my right. Professors Rogoff and Reinhardt have recently summarize the experience of financial crisis, and they show how they last longer than normal downturns, 3 to 4 years, and how they are much more violent. On the low end, they imply a peak to trough decline in GDP of 4%. On the high end, 25%. Because unemployment is rising at such a rapid rate, considerations about pent-up demand in housing and automobiles, Larry Summers made this point recently, that we need 1.7 million, as I recall, housing starts to keep up with demand. We've got 400,000 and so on. You can make similar arguments on cars. But with unemployment rising at these rates, these kinds of considerations on pent-up demand do not apply. I mean, at some point, we're going to get a recovery. But it's very unlikely that people confronted with a high probability of a job loss are going to go out and buy cars and houses. And of course, the effectiveness of policy is lessened greatly when uncertainty is so great. Fiscal policy, tax cuts can be saved. I could talk more about that. Monetary policy, you have Keynes's and others' liquidity trap, etc. You pump money in and it gets saved. So this is one of the reasons I think that our forecasts have and our points of reference actually are challenged completely by the episode that we are observing. Now, let me move to the second point, which is recession may still be the most likely scenario. And if you push me into a dark alley and put a gun to my head and tell me what, you know, ask me what my forecast is for next year, I'll still say I think this thing is going to start bottoming out in 2010. That's my best guess. But I have to tell you that I hold that forecast with a very low degree of confidence. And I want to talk a little bit about depression, which I probably couldn't have done when I was working at the World Bank a year ago. What is a depression? We don't even have an accepted definition of a depression. Well, Professor Barrow has helped us recently by declaring that, as far as he's concerned, a small depression is a decline of 10% or more of GDP, that is peak to trough decline, occurring over multiple years. He has, by the way, a definition of a major depression, which is 25%, as I recall, or was it 30%? I don't have the number here. I think it's 30% decline of GDP over multiple years. He then concludes that when the stock market declines by 25% or more in real terms on the basis of several dozen such episodes, 30% of the time you get a mini depression, that is 10% or more decline in GDP. Now, of course, the stock market decline we've had to date is well over 25%. It's more like 50%. And if you ask, well, take a look at the consensus forecast, you know, somewhere close to the IMF and World Bank forecast or the J.P. Morgan forecast, and what is the peak-to-trough decline in GDP implied by those forecasts, you get actually for the United States, for the latest J.P. Morgan forecast, which was just done in March, a 3.5% decline peak-to-trough in GDP. So not even a halfway towards a minor depression. And you have to say, well, are these forecasts credible given what we are watching in terms of the stock market collapses that we've had and the absolutely frightening figures on industrial production and world trade? And my conclusion is that these forecasts must be considered to be held with a low degree of confidence. And I was glad to see that my IMF friend showed large ranges. By the way, a 10% decline in GDP peak to trough would imply unemployment in excess of 15% in this country. The depression forecast is not really widely accepted in among economists, partly because everybody thinks we've had the depression, we've learned all the lessons, we're doing all the right things, et cetera, et cetera. And by and large, that is very probably true. However, the question that people need to address also is, are we facing the same sort of problem as we were during the Great Depression? Is this, are there some aggravating factors in this particular circumstance? And I believe there are. What are these aggravating factors? Well, you know, for a start, we've got this kind of momentum. You know, when you have this kind of downward momentum in the world economy, you can pretty much assume that this thing is not going to turn around very quickly. I mean, people are still very much losing their jobs, and then other people lose their jobs, and so on and so forth. So we are still very much in the very steep part of this curve. That's a start. But a lot of indicators are quite worrying. I mean, the size of the debt in the United States, in the UK, is higher than it's ever been. I mean, I'm talking the aggregate of all debts. And the complexity of financial instruments is unprecedented. A lot of these financial instruments are not only complex, but very non-transparent. I can't tell you right now. We know that there are many trillions of dollars of credit default swaps that are outstanding. And we know that this is sinking AIG. I don't know who else has these credit default swaps. And if you ask the experts, the financial experts, they'll say, we also don't know because there's no clarity in this market. There was never any kind of formal market for these instruments. That's one example, but there are many others that I could cite. The other aggravating factors, there are two other ones that I will mention. One of them is globalization. Now, globalization gives us many good things, and I have no doubt that it accelerates the long-term rate of growth of the world economy. But it also makes countries much more dependent on each other. And when the crisis is global, as it is now, the coordination issues that are raised are just infinitely more complex than they are when you are dealing with a relatively large and isolated economy, as, by the way, was the United States back in the 1930s. The trade-to-GDP ratios in the United States in 1929 was only 4%. And the other issue which has been mentioned is political will issue. I mean, what is very clear, and both Ambassador Bruton and George also mentioned this, the bailouts that we're talking about, the remedial measures we're talking about, have significant distributional impact. And rightly or wrongly, they're viewed by the public as redistributing money from taxpayer onto wealthy Wall Street bankers. And to a degree, they're right. The political will issue of dealing with this problem, therefore, is a major one which I think aggravates this problem. Okay, my third and last point, I don't know how long I've been speaking, but how long have I got? A few more minutes? Okay. So let me say a word then about the third point, which is the need to use all the available policy space. I'm going to disagree a little bit with Hans and with Ambassador Bruton. I think that now the situation is so dire that we need to concentrate 90% of our attention onto fixing, you know, stopping the fire, stopping this collapse here, rather than expending a lot of political capital and time, which is very scarce, on redesigning the system for the future. And in no way do I want to suggest that this is not an important part of what needs to happen. But I just think that we've got a major, major problem to deal with immediately. You look at the policies and I don't have time here to go into detail on the various policies, but I can convey to you the general sense that while policymakers are doing a lot, I think they need to be doing more, and I think they can be doing more. On the fiscal stimulus side, I think this needs to be looked at like you're fighting a war, because this is the magnitude of the problem that you are dealing with. And when we fought wars, I think the UK, if I remember correctly, came out of World War II with a 450% debt to GDP ratio. United States came out of World War II with 125% debt to GDP ratio. Now, in 2009, according to IMF projections, 15 of the 20 in the G20 will have debt to GDP ratios below 80%. And virtually all the developing countries will have debt to GDP ratios below 50%. This is my way of saying, and this is after accounting, presumably, for the fiscal stimulus measures that were contemplated at the time. So what I'm saying is it is possible for most of the G20, not all of them, certainly not countries like Italy, for example, to do quite a lot more on fiscal stimulus than they're doing at the moment. The second point on quantitative easing, Christina Romer, current chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, once wrote a paper that showed that the emergence showed, strongly suggested that the emergence from the Great Depression was due to inflow of gold from Europe beginning in 1933, which led to a large expansion in the money supply in the United States. And that was the main factor that accounted for the turnaround in the U.S. economy beginning in 1933, which, by the way, was quite spectacular, of course, from disastrous levels. So I think we need to look much more carefully at quantitative easing. By and large, as Jorg has mentioned, U.S., Japan, and U.K. are all moving quite rapidly in this direction. I think my impression is that the EU is lacking, and I'd love to hear Ambassador Bruton on that eventually. On the third point, I'm going to agree with Ambassador Bruton there on the dealing with the banks. The U.S. plan, the Geithner plan, comes very late, not because of Geithner, but because of all the complexities that we've seen. It comes very late in the game. This financial crisis is 1.5 years old at least, but it's a step in the right direction. We don't know whether it's going to work. It's a very complex plan. There are many pitfalls, I believe, in the way the plan is structured. But I think everybody needs to move ahead along similar lines, or, you know, there are many variations of the scheme. I think that we need to give this thing 3 months to work. And if it's not working in 3 months, then I think we should move to Plan B, which is the nationalization of those institutions that are most vulnerable. I think the recapitalization of the IMF is likely to be the most concrete achievement of the coming G20 meeting. That's my guess from what I hear. But we should be prepared to do even more. The World Bank's assessment, Hans didn't really mention it today, is that in a low-case scenario in 2009, the refinancing requirement in developing countries will be $700 billion. Well, maybe the IMF needs more than $500 billion. And my last point is on protectionism. I think the protectionist threat is now very real. I did not used to think that even 3 months ago, 4 months ago. But basically, the intensity of the crisis is such, and the extent of government involvement and the distortionary nature of the various bailouts and interventions is such that even when countries don't intend to protect, that is the effect of their intervention, and they will be interpreted to be protecting by their commercial rivals. Furthermore, WTO disciplines, despite the high billing on countries, are actually very, very weak, There are all sorts of ways to get around those disciplines, and the sanctions system is actually very limited, incapable of dealing with a simultaneous rise in a large number of disputes around the world. So I think that the G20 needs to do more in this direction. There are many things. I have written a short paper which details some of the measures. But one thing I would highlight, and I hope that it comes out of the G20 meeting, is to give the WTO formal authority to monitor all changes in trade policy and to oblige the G20, through their agreement, to report all changes in trade policy to the WTO and give the WTO the authority to disseminate these findings both to the General Council, to the G20, and to the wider public. Thank you.
Thank you, Uri, and thank you to all the speakers. Well, we've had a very sobering diagnosis put on the table and a number of policy responses suggested and outlined. We are going to go directly into questions. I should say that Ambassador Bhutan has to leave us a little bit early, so if you have a question specifically directed to him, I will acknowledge those and take those questions, and we will continue on, however, with our discussion to 4 p.m. in general. As always, please identify yourself when you get the microphone and then pose your question. I'd like to take two or three questions, comments at a time, here in the brown jacket.
Judd Harriet, documentary filmmaker. I was listening to Paul Krugman night before last and his commentary on the recent plan to purchase the toxic assets from the bank. His critique was basically that all this will do is simply impart some more liquidity in the market for toxic assets. It will not get to the heart of the banking problem, which is they're undercapitalized. So my question is, should we wait 3 months, or should we move aggressively, parallel with the effort to impart more liquidity to the market for toxic assets, move more aggressively to recapitalize the banks at the same time?
Lawrence McDonald, Center for Global Development. I want to thank all the panelists, and I hope Carnegie will post this terrific slide on your website so I can download it and have it handy. Uri, I was very interested in your comment about a war footing, and I understand that one of the historical analyses of the Great Depression is that, in fact, the stimulus provided at that time was inadequate, and it was the stimulus that came with the war, in fact, that ended the Depression. And, of course, there's the terrifying idea that if we don't avert depression, then what we get is war. And so I'm wondering if it's possible to close the loop between the two big crises threatening the planet, one of which we've discussed today and the other of which wasn't mentioned at all after I arrived, which is the climate crisis. And we know from the geophysical scientists that we're going to need massive investment in the next 10 years to avert climate catastrophe. Could we make that our war footing, and could we have leadership from both economists and our political leaders to say we have a climate crisis that requires many billions of dollars, and would it be easier to mobilize that kind of stimulus, or as the ambassador says, stabilization, by explaining that kind of threat, rather than only saying we need this to pull us out of an economic slump? Thank you.
Peter Battaglia, Johns Hopkins University, SAIS. All of you have stressed the importance of solving the banking problem as a precondition for solving the economic crisis. Solving the banking problem requires, as some of you stressed, taking the toxic assets out of the balance sheets of the commercial of the banks. Many of the assets, toxic assets, some of in the form of credit default swaps, are not held on the balance sheets of these banks. And we don't know much about them. We don't even know how much of that particular instrument is outstanding there and how much, who holds it. What is your view on the credit default swap issue? How can we deal with it, even if we nationalize the banks, since we don't know what's out there? And it is not on any balance sheet.
How best to do that is a matter that I'm not going to enter into. But debt to equity swaps seem to be the obvious way. If I knew for sure that we could spend the money on climate change in a way that would actually reduce climate change substantially, yes, I'd agree with you. But many of the climate change reducing technologies are not mature. And it could be argued that even spending money at this stage on things that are a complete waste of time could actually be worthwhile and justifiable because of such a deficiency in demand in the economy that simply spending the money is good in and of itself. But I think the public would want to be a bit more convinced that actually what you'd be spending it on would make a difference. I think the most attractive way of dealing with this is to spend on energy conservation, because we do have pretty good technology on how to conserve energy. We're not so well advanced in all cases on other forms of new energy, but conserving energy in buildings and in factories and on roads and in public transport, those are all things I think we could spend on because the technology is mature. And I have to say, I don't know how to deal with credit default swaps. I'm not an expert. I'm neither an expert nor a leader. But as we were all introduced as being one or both, but I'm neither.
Well, unfortunately, I think our experts and our leaders have also indicated that they're not quite sure how to do it. Other panelists on any of these questions?
Maybe just a comment on the Krugman comment. I mean, I think no one's proposing to wait for 3 months before we start wondering about recap. As far as I understand, there are stress tests ongoing for the U.S. banks. On that basis, there will be a determination of how much capital will be needed in which institutions, and I would expect that the administration then comes up with plans to address these needs. So in that sense, I agree. The problem needs to be tackled on several fronts, one of which is removal of toxic assets, pricing toxic assets, and the other is recap. But something is happening on the recap front. I just have to wait for the results.
Yeah, all questions actually have a common theme, and that is, should you focus on the defense, trying to keep the system alive, trying to replenish the lack of the demand, trying to use additional liquidity to get the market working where, or should you be on the offense, given the fact that you know that it's very difficult to keep the same system alive as we had it in, a year ago? And then you can see even the crisis as an opportunity, that you can have new initiatives in green technologies, that you focus more on climate change, that you change it. I think it's good to go back to the early 80s and the experience in Europe and other parts of the world, where I think the policies were too defensive, and ultimately they paid the price. The analysis after the first and the second oil crisis was somewhat similar as the analysis at the moment, in the sense that we had a huge transfer of money from oil importing to oil exporting countries. Oil exporters were not consuming that money, so there was suddenly an enormous drop in effective demand, and everybody came to the conclusion that here you need gains, and we have to spend, and we have to save the existing industries that suffer from a temporary fall in demand, with the idea also just to have destruction of capital. So there was a huge spending in Europe to keep the heavy industry alive, to continue with the shipbuilding, not realizing that what the crisis had shown was a change in comparative advantage in the world that suddenly became apparent in Europe, and that there was something that we were not able to save anyhow. So that created a huge build-up of debt in the government that created what you could say almost a lost 80s with very low growth. The same happened in Latin America, of course. And then at the end of the 80s, Europe lost anyhow the industries, because those heavy industries went anyhow to the United States. So whether you think about the toxic assets in the banking system, or whether you think about car industries or existing industries that have problems, it is not necessarily always the best option to try to prevent the slowdown that actually has already occurred. And it does make sense to think about the new opportunities that are out there. And the point that I would make is the one that I put on the table in the presentation also, that there are at the moment in the developing countries huge opportunities of investments with a big payout which can create further growth. One of the reasons that especially in high-income countries production is falling now so sharply is that suddenly the high-income countries are not exporting anymore to developing countries. Over the last couple of years, growth was still strong in the high-income countries despite the fact that there was a necessary fall in domestic demand, because there was still a lot of exports of capital goods to developing countries that could use it in a very productive way. That is no longer there, and you see a sharp reduction in production. It does make sense to think about the new opportunities of the next decade, and if you're thinking about stimulus, not just to stimulate your own economy, but think more in a global way so that you can stimulate those countries where there's a huge growth potential, which ultimately will benefit and also your exports.
Yes, on the climate change, since Lawrence also asked me directly, I mean, as I suggested in my presentation, I think there is scope for some countries to spend more than they're spending at the moment to deal with the crisis as part of the stabilization policies. So there may be opportunities for very, very high return investments on climate change, such as and fairly sure investments, such as energy conservation. But I don't think we should be left with the impression that, you know, in the middle of this financial crisis, we have a shortage of ideas on how to spend money. I was just in Russia, China, and the Middle East just before I came here. And believe me, I mean, there are a lot of issues immediately requiring attention. Even in this country, in yesterday's press conference, the president indicated the issue of, you know, homeless children. In Russia, 30% of the population is below the poverty line at the moment, a lot of pensioners, et cetera. There's a huge social agenda that needs to be supported as we go through this episode, if for no other reason, not just for moral reasons, if for no other reason than if we have 15% unemployment, we're going to have an explosion in various places. Difficult to say when and where. And last but not least, I think part of the reason we've been so hesitant to move ahead on the banks is that I think politically it's extraordinarily difficult to accept the cost of the bailout that is implied. And this is at the heart of the hesitancy that we have seen in the course of the last year and a half, is the reluctance to say, okay, we're going to take, you know, 10% of GDP, because typically 15% of GDP, typically this is what these crisis, financial crises cause, and support the banking system. So I just want to convey the point that there's a lot of things that government money needs to do at the moment. We have no shortage of immediate issues to deal with, although certainly some aspects of climate change deserve attention.
Thanks. My name is Mark Castellano with the Government Accountability Office. I have a question about the one of the chief firefighters, if you will, that is the IMF. Yesterday they announced a pretty significant set of reforms. Was curious, two questions there. One is, does that reform represent a true departure? And number two, what does this mean in a practical sense? How will it play out, that is, in countries like Ukraine, the Latvias, Romania just yesterday is starting a new program? How will we see it manifest, and is it going to help?
Hi, I'm Ben Carliner from the Economic Strategy Institute. I'd like to follow up on that question and raise the issue of global imbalances and specifically ask if the lesson that many countries seem to take away from the 97 Asian financial crisis, that it's good to have large stocks of foreign exchange reserves as a sort of insurance policy against sudden stops in capital inflows, whether that's being reinforced by the current crisis. And if so, is this a threat to the long-term economic recovery? And if it is, what should we do about it?
Hi, my name is David Kane with the Mary Knoll Office for Global Concerns. My question is, especially for the ambassador, a real concern of ours with the G20 plan is the idea that most or perhaps all of the money will be going through the IMF. And the IMF has a multi-decade history of conditionalities that go exactly contrary to what is needed today. I mean, even in contracts that the IMF signed a few months ago in the middle of this crisis, they continue with the same contractionary, telling governments to restrict spending, to cut public services, cut healthcare and things. So we're just really concerned that if the money goes through the IMF, what sort of guarantees will there be that those conditionalities won't continue? That would sort of undermine the whole purpose of the stimulus.
Yeah, Robert Kiepitz. I'm struck by the fact that we've had four very dour views of the outlook. In fact, really one very dour view of the outlook. And it's not clear to me why there seems to be an assumption that because the downturn has been exceptionally deep, it's also going to be exceptionally long. And I'm wondering what you're not seeing that or what you perhaps could see that would convince you that, in fact, the world economy is going to bounce back fairly quickly.
I think that the point that's been made by others on the platform, with which I would agree, that the rapidity of the decline in production is so enormous that it has built up an almost a self-reinforcing momentum, both in the psychology of the public and in the reality of the business world, and that momentum is likely to make the decline longer than it would otherwise be. On the question about the IMF, it is important to make the point that the IMF is an intergovernmental organization, and it is governments that decide the policy of the IMF. And if governments want to change the policy of the IMF, they can change the policy of the IMF. And my sense of the discussion we're having now is that, if you like, the philosophy of economics that was prevalent even 12 months ago has been dumped by almost everybody. And there is now an entirely different view being taken. People who would have been horrified at the idea of deficit spending 12 months ago are now saying we can't have enough of it. And I think, therefore, your worries about what might have been the past approach of the IMF to conditionality, I think, are not worries that you should have, because I think the IMF is going to be guided to not to have no conditions, of course there have to be conditions, but to have conditions that emphasize interdependence and emphasize multiplier effects and emphasize open markets, but at the same time emphasize the need to ensure that we don't have social collapse. So that would be my sense of it. I don't know, I mean, there are people from the IMF here, but they'd probably tell you better. My own sense as well about the global imbalances point is I think this is we all knew that the situation whereby Americans were spending a huge amount more than they were earning, borrowing more than they could in most likely circumstances repay, and the Chinese were saving more than they ought to be saving and exporting more than they were consuming, that was not going to continue forever. Now, the question was, how was it going to be brought to an end? what everybody was saying it had to end. Now we know how it's ending. And I think that that's why I say, you know, the idea that somehow or other we're going to get back to 2006 is just off the charts. That can't happen because 2006 wasn't sustainable. So we do have to have some sort of a sense of what the new distribution of production and consumption and of what in the world is going to have to be spelled out for people. And I think part of the job of the G20, in addition to all the good things that they're going to do, is to actually paint a picture of what the world might look like 5 years from now. Not a plan, because you know, planning is probably beyond what these people can do. They can't ordain the future. But at least to give a sense of a scenario of what the world might look like if we do all these things, so that people will have something to work towards, a sort of a sense of a goal. I think that's what's needed. And I think that's, you know, I think that's in its essence a political task. It's not a task that economists are particularly good at. It's not a, you know, it's not a task that financiers are particularly good at. It's a political picture painting exercise, which politicians should be good at. And I think politicians need to have the confidence to you know, take this problem to themselves and say, look, we've got to persuade people that there's hope. And this is I'm not just using the word hope, but actually showing what they're hoping for.
Yes, well, let me take the questions on the IMF. The first is, what we've decided yesterday is a true departure relative to what we've done before, and the answer to that is unequivocally yes, and in two dimensions. The first is that we've introduced a so-called flexible credit line. This is a kind of insurance mechanism. We haven't had that before. How does it work? Basically, if you are a country that has policies that are considered good along various dimensions, then you can apply for a credit line that you can draw down if and when you need it, without any conditionality being imposed during the time when you're drawing it down. It is beforehand that we make a judgment as to whether the policies are sufficiently strong so as to warrant warrant them being insured by the IMF, and you pay a commitment fee, you know, for getting that insurance. That's something completely new. This is country insurance in which we are going right now. The second departure is that we are moving, that we're changing conditionality. We are moving completely away from what we call structural conditionality. We will be focused on macroeconomic conditionality. That is to say, these are conditions that regard the macroeconomic framework, things such as credit, money growth, reserves, and stuff like this. We're moving away from structural conditionality. There was a remark here that we keep on recommending the same bad old policies, and that we are advocating, that we are in that context also with specific programs now, pushing for healthcare cuts. I think there's an issue of information here. We are not pushing healthcare cuts anywhere on the country. I know in the Latvia program there's an explicit recognition that healthcare expenditure is supposed to be protected. Social expenditure is supposed to be protected everywhere. And as I've just made quite clear here, we are supporting fiscal stimulus. In fact, as Mr. Ambassador John Bruton probably knows, I've been working on the European on the euro area consultations, and we've always been asking for stronger fiscal adjustment during good times. And there's a reason why we've been asking this, so that you have the buffers to use them up in bad times, and that's what we are pushing for now. Now, the problem with many emerging market countries is that for them, the ability to use fiscal policy in bad times is limited because their capital market access is heavily constrained, right? So where we can step in and with our funding permit some loosening of policies, we do so. But in some areas, it's just not possible because they don't have access to capital markets. There was a question here on global imbalances. What will happen to global imbalances in the future? I think self-insurance, which is what has motivated the accumulation of reserves and has contributed, it's been one important factor behind these global imbalances, is the key issue here. With our flexible credit lines, we're offering an insurance mechanism. Are countries going to go for this, or are they continuing to self-insure? Very hard to tell. Very hard to tell. I mean, it depends how successful we are in removing the stigma associated with IMF, with tapping IMF funds. I mean, we're trying our best on that front. As I say, you know, access to the FCL is a mark of distinction, and so we hope that this will attract countries and therefore reduce self-insurance in the future. But the jury on that is out. Finally, there was a question, why are we going to come back so quickly from the slowdown? Well, if the projections pan out the way we have, the way we are seeing it, it's actually not a quick comeback. It's actually a pretty long recession. You could still question, well, why are we coming out you know, so strongly as we are forecasting? Aren't the risks on the downside? And I've already said, yes, they are on the downside. But we shouldn't forget that policies in many advanced economies are now highly stimulative. And that should help us get out of the recession, and that the moves on the financial sector, you know, are encouraging. I mean, there's more to be done, but they are encouraging. The policies are becoming more specific. And finally, if you follow the U.S. housing market, their defaults and prices are increasingly decelerating. And you know, I think there is a good chance that by the end of this year or early next year, there's a bottoming out in that market, and that should help provide support to all these financial instruments that are causing the troubles on bank balance sheets. So on the whole, I think there are reasons to believe that we get out of this in 2010, but still, I would agree that the risks are on the downside relative to the projections that we have.
Let me also respond to that last question about the bounce back. My answer is no, we are not expecting that it will take long to bounce back because the fall is deep. But there is a high probability that it takes long because it started with a financial crisis. And as the IMF showed with a couple of papers, that every recession that starts with a financial crisis takes also longer. But we are actually looking at all kinds of signs trying to see when the bounce back could come. Yesterday and the day before was positive news on the housing market. If you follow the commodity markets, then you see some stabilization and even a bounce back. And then, of course, there is a lot of stimulus in the system. But the point that I would want to make, that even if you return to positive growth, in 2010, then still you will have the problems that are generating by this big fall with you. And those problems will be probably with you also in 2011, because you don't need just going back to positive growth. You need a period of growth above the historical average just to undo the gap that has been generated by the fall now. We are now far below what you could call full employment equilibrium, and it's not enough to just have normal growth again. You need really growth, both potential, for quite some time to get rid of the problem that has been generated now. And that's why this is so depressing.
I just want to come back to one of the points on the what would we look for the pickup? One of the reasons I think we're all gloomy, but maybe I was a little gloomier than the others, perhaps because I dared to use the depression word, which is difficult to do when you're in an official capacity. The complication now, compared to a lot of the financial crisis that are part of the sample in the slides that were shown, is that you have a collapse of world trade. I mean, in the financial crisis sample, there are dozens and dozens of these financial crises, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, that occur against the background of, you know, relative normalcy in world trade, not necessarily a boom, but not a bust either. So the standard way of getting out of financial crisis has happened many times in emerging markets over the last 30, 40 years, you know, big devaluation, et cetera, some fiscal adjustment to give confidence to the markets, et cetera, et cetera, and reduce the current account deficit. All of this doesn't really work in this case, because there's no traction from the global system. And that is one of the reasons that I think we are, unfortunately, into a deeper, longer episode than a lot of people suspect. What I would look for in terms of turnaround, yes, I could say, I'm going to look at the symptoms, the cardiogram, the commodity prices and the housing prices, et cetera, to signal the change in conditions. But I really I'm going to mistrust those short-term indicators until I see improvement in the fundamental cause of the problem. And the fundamental cause of the problem is the collapse, or not collapse, but the tremendous strain in the credit system around the world. So when I see a really aggressive and effective action on the banks, then I will begin to feel comfortable that we're beginning to turn the corner. So far, I haven't seen that.
How much of the credit default swaps are housing related? And if the housing market here is going to recover, how good a sign is that for the resolution of these problems?
I really have no idea how big the housing is relative to credit default swaps on emerging markets, credit default swaps on companies. I mean, these credit default swaps now are applied to just about every financial instrument, and maybe Jorg has a better answer. I do suspect that it's a significant number just because of the importance of the mortgages in the portfolios around the world. And I would agree that improvement in housing prices is an important element of that, is a significant element, but it is only one part of the more complex picture.
I mean, just to add, I think that not knowing what is in the various credit default swaps is precisely one of the problems in trying to deal with the toxic assets. We have time for one more round of questions if there are any remaining questions in the audience. Yes.
I had a question for Ambassador Bruton. He stressed so much the public utility nature of banks. What should be done to get banks to behave as such? Do you think nationalization would help?
I don't think nationalization in and of itself is desirable at all, because it creates all these problems that public choice theory economics has told us about, people acting to in their own interests under the guise of the public interest, and also distortions of good banking practice by political considerations. I think that the key, and I'm really not an expert on this subject, even less than on some of the other things I've expatiated about. But I think that what has been missing in the banking system is any sort of human link between the people who are making decisions about credit and the people who are receiving the credit. Knowledge cannot all be acquired from books of from lists of figures and calculations. We understand people, and there's all sorts of parts of our intuitive equipment that enables us to see somebody on the other side of the table and have a sense that this person will repay or won't repay. And that personal element, I think, has been slowly over many years removed from the banking system, and I think that trying to finding a way where that is reintroduced to a greater extent would be helpful. But I've no doubt that that's not the most important thing. I'm sure there are lots more important things that others here could suggest.
Glenn Rogers with USAID. You've talked a lot about some of the indicators in a, from an economic sense, but on the political economy, what would be the indicator of bottoming or turning the corner on the threats of protectionism or some of the other political economy threats that you've mentioned?
Thibaut Delour. I come from France, so sorry about my poor English. I'm working for the Peterson Institute for International Economics. My question was about inequalities as a factor of the current crisis with on the lower side of the social scale, very low salaries, creating a huge demand for credit, and on the other side of the social scale, lots of corporate profits, which eventually create a huge supply of credit. Do you think that could have had a role in the current crisis?
Let's see, I didn't expect you to start with me. What was the first question? I can't remember the first question.
Political economy indicators. What would be the political economy?
Yeah, no, the most important thing that I think would reduce protectionist pressure is a quick recovery. I mean, you can think of a number of things that you can do to mitigate the problem. But in a situation where the fundamentals are of collapsing activity, rising unemployment, and increased government interventions with bailouts in specific sectors that are subject to international competition, this is like, you know, this is a very bad mixture, very bad. And since there's no alternative to government intervention in the current context, the only thing that will radically change the political dynamic is if we get a recovery. And that's why the policies of recovery and quick recovery are absolutely fundamental. The question of inequality is a very interesting question, a very deep question, one that therefore cautiously I will avoid answering at this point.
Now, I would agree that under the current circumstances, you can only expect more protectionary calls to come about, not only in trade, but also in the bailout programs that the population wants to focus more and more on their domestic economies. And when they realize how much is going actually to other countries, that creates those tendencies. But let me point at one positive element. And that is, you do see more international cooperation than we used to have. The fact that we are all talking about the G20 at the moment, even if not a lot of hard measures are coming out there, still we think it very important. G20 is different from G7 or G8. And more you see that some of the emerging big economies are getting a bigger voice in those international discussions, and I think that's ultimately very important for the solution.
I think it's possible to argue that inequality has been significantly reduced by the recession. I think it's likely that the biggest proportionate losses have been taken, at least in the initial part of the downturn, by people with very large holdings of wealth who have seen that wealth, you know, reduced dramatically in its value. Now, I know that as unemployment starts to spread, there it's possible that, you know, that will increase inequality, because it's possible that those who lose their jobs will be people who will, you know, would be suddenly find themselves much, much poorer. But in its initial manifestation, I think that it's arguable, I've certainly read people arguing this, that it actually reduced inequality. Now, what are the reasons for inequality in society? I think they are partly to do with the obsession with short-term returns, in the way that the stock market demands star performances from star individuals, and if a company is losing some star manager, that immediately has an effect on its share price, and the shareholders are demanding short-term maintenance of share price value rather than looking at the long-term interests of the company. I think it's that, it's though that sort of thing that's driving inequality, plus the celebrity effect. You know, the biggest driver of inequality possibly is, you know, the television and people becoming celebrities and thereby being able to command these phenomenal salaries because simply of their celebrity, which also affects business in some ways. Now, I don't know how we can deal with that. I mean, how do you turn off all televisions and say that you're not going to allow people to become famous? I don't know. Anyway.
You have a final comment?
Yeah, just on the inequality part, I mean, I think you're also alluding to something very important, which is the consumer protection dimension of the crisis that has hit. I mean, people have been sold instruments or credits that shouldn't have been sold to them. And so there is a consumer protection issue here, a big one, and I think there are efforts on the way to try and address these, but I think it's also a good wake-up call for policymakers that this is a very important dimension that we should neglect as we reform the financial system.
Let me ask you to join me.